one to me. This song is one of those that kind of warms us all up, so that perhaps throughout the afternoon we will be singing together. We kind of get a chance to open up right away, so that we're not going to get restless. And the song, the chorus, is you perhaps have learned as Viva l'Amour. And the words have been changed. Viva la, one and all. Viva la, large and small. Viva la you, viva la me, viva la company. Said every good fellow not joining the song, viva la company. Said to each other and pass it along.
A 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7,
do a little 8. Bit more so that you know you've got it.
Right.
Read something from the paper, a busy day for a royal bachelor.
Oh, I don't want to read that. I want to read something worthwhile. Have you heard the new song? It's called What Color is a Man?
No.
No, what
it's
is
a
that?
Real good song. It goes, it was a little boy who was sitting on his daddy's knee playing with his coloring book. He said, Dad, this is the man I want to be. But Dad, what color is a man? When I grow up, I want to be happy. I want to be good and free. When I grow up, I want to be wealthy. What crayon should I use to color me? Well, if you color him blue, son, he won't be a happy man. And if you color him red, someone may steal his land. And if you color him blue or yellow, he may be jealous. If you color him green or yellow, he may be jealous or cowardly. And if you color him black, he may never be free. Now, son, put your crayons away. There's something that I have to say. A man isn't made of any color at all. A man is nothing but a man.
Oh, that's lovely.
Okay, now see what
who
you
wrote
got.
That?
I don't know.
You want to get the declaration?
Well, I could get that. Would you wait one moment, please?
Yeah, I think it ought to go.
All right, I have this thing. It was distributed in many forms. This one here is the bulletin of the assembly that was given to all participants. It's the Declaration of Peace. It says, and this was read simultaneously, unanimously, what's the word I'm thinking of?
In chorus.
In unison.
Boy, that must have been so.
In unison by everybody, it said. Because for 20 years the people of Vietnam have been tortured, burned, and killed, because their land and crops have been ruined and their culture has been destroyed, and because we refuse to have these things done in our name, we declare peace with the people of Vietnam. Because millions of Americans had hoped and expected that their votes in the 1964 presidential election would move our country away from war toward peace, and because these hopes and expectations have been betrayed in Vietnam, we declare peace with the people of Vietnam. Because the Congress of the United States, without adequate discussion, has permitted the waging of an undeclared war, we symbolically assume its responsibility for this day in the name of those people of the United States and of the world who oppose this war, and declare peace with the people of Vietnam. Because we believe that the steady escalation of the war in Vietnam threatens all people with nuclear death, we declare peace with the people of Vietnam. Because we believe that people all over the world must find ways to make peace with each other and to keep their governments from ever waging war, we declare peace with the people of Vietnam. We commit ourselves to a continuing effort to implement this declaration of peace. You are invited to write a declaration of your own. This was given to all participants and was read many times in unison. Then, arrest started. Before the arrest started, about an hour before, he said that arrest would start in 10 minutes, and we were given 10 minutes to clear out. Nobody left, and arrest started an hour later. Mass arrest. First, they just arrested the person that was speaking. Somebody got up and spoke, off he went. Somebody else got up and spoke, off he went. Pretty soon, there was nobody left. Nobody that could even possibly be considered a leader. Dave Dillinger was possibly a leader. Staunton Lynn was certainly a leader. Bob Parrish was a leader. A.J. Musty was possibly a leader.
Did they arrest him?
He was not. Did not take part in this thing. But Eric Weinberger was possibly a leader. Everybody there that might possibly be considered a leader had been arrested. And all that was left was us, the hoi polloi, the rabble. And we conducted this assembly in a much more orderly manner than it had ever been able to be conducted with leaders. And this was amazing. When a
leaders just step out of the group?
It was just fantastic because there were no real leaders. It was just people that assumed leadership, and nobody had really the energy or the desire to challenge them. But after these people were arrested, these quote experienced unquote people were arrested, we had a much better and much better assembly when or disorderly conduct was given against these people arrested. It was just fantastic because they were not disorderly at all. It was very orderly.
Just that I came out of the group.
Yeah. Well, I was arrested and I went limp, as most of the other people did, and we had to be carried to the paddy wagon. Well, in this paddy wagon.
You were sitting on the grass. Did you intend to be arrested?
Yes.
You were.
I intended to get arrested. I knew that I was under 18 and I knew the consequences, and I decided that I was going to get arrested. And I did.
And Robin would just...
Robin had decided she wasn't. Larry was with me. We had found earlier that day, and Judy was with me. And we had all decided we were not going to get arrested with Robin. But something happened, and we did. We just felt we couldn't leave. Mm-hmm. Robin felt she could, and she did, and Robin perhaps did the most intelligent, the smartest thing.
She just walked away.
Yeah.
And you all stayed. Then
we were arrested and carried into the paddy wagon.
What did you do? Just go limp and they had and they carried you?
From the paddy wagon.
How many people carried you? How many cops?
Four.
Four cops?
There was one girl named Sandy from Jackson, Mississippi. One of the most beautiful things I've seen. It took seven policemen to put her in that paddy wagon. It was just great. You could tell she knew all about this kind of thing because they picked her up and she squirmed. She didn't ever strike a cop, but she squirmed and they tried to put her in a paddy wagon and she grabbed on and climbed on top of it and they grabbed her by the legs and pulled her down and she fell on top of one of the policemen and rolled away and they had to chase her again. And it took seven policemen to put her in that paddy wagon. It was really great. So then we were all arrested. And we were taken first.
How many were in the paddy wagon?
About 30.
30, all crowded.
It was a bus.
A bus?
Small bus. They had one paddy wagon. They had many paddy wagons. These paddy wagons were six people at the most. They packed 12 people into one of these things.
You were just sitting on top of each other?
One paddy wagon, three people comfortably, they're made for six. If you pack, they put 12 people in one of these things, left it in this hot sun. I've told you again and again how hot it was. And fed ammonia gas through the vent.
They had ammonia gas on the outside through the vents?
Right.
Okay. What do you have, squirt guns or something?
I'm not sure. This is just a rumor. I'm not accusing the policemen, but they have been accused of this in court. And they are now standing trial. I don't know how it's come out. I'm sure it's not over yet. They made a mistake, though. One press person was taking interviews of people being demonstrated, and he got arrested. And he was in this paddy wagon, and he passed out.
From the heat.
From the heat and from the ammonia. And wrote the most beautiful article
I think I read that.
It was a New York Times guy, and it was reprinted in part in the Washington Post, and I'm sure in many other newspapers.
Mm-hmm.
What newspaper did you read it in? You know?
Omaha.
Well, it was reprinted in Washington, part in Washington Post. That was their mistake. We were taken first to Court of General Sessions where they couldn't get us in. Then they took us, I'll make this short because...
Can you tell about the girl they threw against the wall?
I'm getting there.
Oh, don't make it short.
Well...
I mean, I'd like to hear
it. All right. They drove us all around the city to this, what we found out later was a federal jail. And we had been told, it was meant kind of a joke, but we found out it was true, that those of us arrested today could possibly be charged with contempt of Congress. Mm. We decided we had more contempt for that Congress.
You'd be guilty.
But that's 5 years, but nobody was charged with that.
What would they do, take you out when you went to the first court and then put you back in?
No, the bus drove in.
And found out there wasn't room?
Found out while we were sitting out in the sun all this time. In this bus, one cop had gone with his billy club swinging randomly in the windows. He's a real, real sad sadist. And one kid got a concussion from it. They took us to the federal jail and drove into what we believed was a garage big enough for this bus. The garage door closed, and we found out this wasn't a garage. This was an elevator for the bus, and the whole bus went down.
Oh, my God.
Somebody hollered laughingly, "Don't take any showers." And for about a fraction of a second, everybody started to smile. Then somebody said, "Hey, that's not a joke." And we realized that nobody knew where we were, and each and every one of us could be murdered. I know it's far-fetched.
No, it's not.
But nobody would know what happened to us, and they can deny, because they took tens and tens and tens of busloads, and they can deny that they took one more, one less, very easily. And we could just be the one, because this was the weirdest setup we've ever been in. The lights were out. We couldn't see a thing.
You were in an elevator going down.
In a bus that was in an elevator. Going down. Finally, the lights went on. And in the meantime, one guy had been instructing all of us on our rights when arrested. Lights went on. He said, "All right, women out first." And about half of the women in the bus went out, and the rest just sat there smiling. He said, "Listen, you put us in here, you can take us out." And he said, "All right, all you men out." And somebody hollered, "Hey, if they've got guts, we sure do." So not a single man left. And each and every one of us had to be dragged out of there. But Judy Barnes, who I mentioned earlier, had been really roughed up, carried out of there by four policemen. She carried out of that bus. They slammed her against the wall. Well, actually, she slid across the floor. All
they
of us were in there.
They
threw her. She slid across the floor and stand up, and she looked up and looked at this police officer, and blood was coming down from her eyelids and from her nose. And she looked at the police officer in the calmest, breathy, beautiful voice of Judy Barnes, called him a fascist beast. And she got a big ovation. Then one guy got up there, and he said, "All right, what's your name, place of birth, address," you know, all the stuff that he had to know. And the guy looked him right in the eye and said, "My name, it ain't nothing, my age, it means less. The land that I live in is called the Midwest. I was born and brought up there, the laws to abide." And he stopped there. You know, he was in jail. And nobody, well, some people did give him information. A lot of people didn't, though. And a lot of people were thrown in jail. I got up there. Name, address. I said, my name is Mr. Tilson. I told him what my name was. What's your age? I said, I ain't gonna tell you. And he said, what? He says, as a matter of fact, I'm not gonna tell you anything else except for my name until you give me a phone call. No one else had been allowed a phone call. I knew this. And I said, I've got a lawyer in town, and I want to call him right now. And you have to give me a phone call right now. The guy laughed. The guy laughed, and he said, you didn't have to give me anything. And he wasn't going to give me anything until I told him how old I was. Gave him all this information. Two policemen grabbed me. This is how I told you. One story. Grabbed me. Two policemen grabbed me. And one of them grabbed my wallet. Which was a mistake. I should never have brought any identification with me. But I did. He pulled out my driver's license and found out that I was under 18. So I got shoved into another cell. I walked in there and I looked up after you pushed in there. And I looked up and there's this guy carrying a SNCC worker's button. His name was Bob. I looked up and he smiled down at me and said, freedom, brother. And I smiled and I took his hand. He helped me up. He said, you under 18 too? He said, yeah, I am. I said, where are you from? He says, oh, I live in D.C. He says, I work in Washington SNCC. I said, oh, I'm from the Midwest. Yeah. So we got talking. I really got to be, in the 2 hours I spent in jail with that guy, we got to be quite good friends. Then, we were carried upstairs and taken to juvenile hall. And we were taken about an hour and a half ride all around the city in a police car with the siren wailing, zooming down streets, making turns on one right wheels like we were an ambulance vehicle, you know, going through red lights with the siren wailing. We thought we were going out of the district to Virginia. Bob kept saying, I know this city real well and I can't follow this route. You know, and where we ended up was the courthouse, which Bob thought he recognized it. He said, no, it can't be the D.C. courthouse. This can't be the D.C. courthouse. It sure looks like it, but it can't be. It was the D.C. courthouse. And the reason that Bob didn't think it could be is this was across the street from the jail we had left. And then, as a matter of fact, we ended up in the same parking lot that we started out from. And had to walk across the street to the D.C. courthouse. The reason Bob was so astonished is because it was across the street. And obviously, somebody was trying to trail us. I mean, we're going through red lights and around corners and everything there, you know. Nobody could obviously have followed us, you know? This is obviously the reason. And we ended up the same place we started. We went upstairs, and they took our names and address, and I was with Bob, and we met about, we got thrown in this little teeny room, which is about half the size of our bathroom, which had about 40 people in it. No, about 20. 20 people in it. All of us under 18, or, you know, and all of us arrested in this demonstration. And we walked in there and looked at each other and he said, what do you want? We all said, peace! When? Now! And we just rocked that place, you know. And the guy walked in there, he says, listen, he says, you guys right now, all of you got 2 counts of disorderly conduct, resisting arrest on you. He says, you guys shut up or I'll throw another count of disorderly. All right, we'll shut up. So we shut up. Well, we were sitting in there, and they took us, and this one great big guy named Rex was taking Bob's application, what do you want to call it, police report, writing down, taking all the vital statistics. They took mine. They said, what's your father's name? And I told them. So your father live in the same place you do? They said, no, he lives at 1210 Minnesota building. He looked at me and said, that's a law office. I said, yeah, I know. I was giving this guy a real hard time. He was getting madder and madder at me. And he asked me for my address at home, and I wouldn't give it to him. I wouldn't give anything to him. And I said, listen, I got a lawyer in town, and I had the office of Washington, Robbins, Davis, and Lyons, and I wanted to write him a letter. I mean, I wanted to call him. I had their telephone number. The guy says, you get a phone call just as soon as I get all this information, and not before. And he gave me this big story, which I found out later did not have a bit of truth in it. But whether it had truth in it doesn't matter, because if this guy believed it, he was going to enforce it. He said that juveniles had no rights. He said that I did not have the right as a juvenile to a phone call. I did not have the right as a juvenile to habeas corpus to find out why I was there.
Oh.
Said I did not have the right as a juvenile to even ever be released. I could be kept there indefinitely. As a juvenile, I had none of the rights as of a citizen. Well, I didn't know anything about the law. And here was this police officer, supposedly a sergeant of the law, who was supposed to explain the law to me, apparently, and this is what he was telling me. So I naturally believed him. So what could I do? I believed him. And I gave him all the information. By the time I got a phone call, it was 6:30. Now, neither Stan Robbins nor Ron Jackson's telephone number are in any phone book. Information won't give out their home numbers. They were not in the office at 6:30. This guy knew damn well that I couldn't get a hold of my attorney at that hour on a Monday night. He said the attorney knew damn well it was impossible for me to do it. You know, I just couldn't find out his home number. So we got thrown back. So we all got taken down to the juvenile retaining home. Except for this Bob, who I'd been thrown with. And we said, where's Bob? You know? One guy says, oh, that kid. He says, he's getting a third degree. So what for? Oh, he's being held under the Cranberry Act. We find out later, the Cranberry Act. I think we found out there is an act that said the name of it is something like Cranberry, which simply says there are certain cases when the juvenile, if he commits a felony, can be treated as an adult. It's a local DC law which says that if a felony is committed by a juvenile, there are certain times when he can be treated as an adult. And if this is what Bob had, fine, but I cannot possibly see what felony he could have committed. Disorderly conduct, resisting arrest, these are all misdemeanors. The only felony I can possibly think of would be assault of an officer of the law, but Bob didn't. Or one person was arrested for assault, or possibly contempt of Congress. I don't know. Would that be a felony? Contempt of Congress? But nobody was arrested for that. I'm sure that would have been publicized. So we don't know what it was that Bob did. He did the same thing we did. And he was not treated. The only difference between Bob and us is he was a D.C. citizen and we weren't. It's the only difference.
You ever see him again?
I never saw him again. I never heard about him again. He was separated from the rest of us.
Who was it?
This was Bob. I can't remember. I told you about Bob.
He's not the one his father called him.
No.
Whose father called
him? Well, we got there. There was one person there named Bill Weil, who had a father who was an attorney in D.C. He lived in New York, but his father was a D.C. attorney, and I understand. Either his father commuted from New York to Washington each day, or his parents were separated, or he wasn't living at home. Or something, anyway. His father was a D.C. lawyer, so he got a hold of his father, somehow. Father came and took all of our names and addresses, and I made it clear to him that I wanted him to call Stan Robbins in Washington. But I didn't think Stan knew who I was, so I wrote on this thing that I was Kenneth Tilson's son, and Kenneth Tilson was a partner of St. Paul office of Robbins, Davis, and Lyons, and that I was, you know, and he thought that I wanted him to call my father in St. Paul. So, he did, and he never did call Stan Robbins. And I assume you called Stan Robbins. You didn't call? Judy Barnes called Stan. Judy Barnes got off that night because Washington SDS, of which she is a member, of which Vance, her boyfriend, is very high, and paid her bond and got her out of jail. She called Stan Robbins.
And how did you get out?
And Stan Robbins got me out the next day, about 4 o'clock, after spending all night and all afternoon in the juvenile detention home, starting riots, inciting riots. We tried to.
What job at the home?
And in the home, we walked in there. There were 18 juvenile boys and 20 juvenile girls arrested. They immediately separated boys from girls as soon as we got to the home. Girls were sent somewhere else. The boys, we walked in there clapping hands, singing, "I ain't afraid of your jail, cause I want my freedom." No, no. "Ain't gonna let no receiving home turn us round, turn us round. Ain't gonna let no Herman Cole, who was the director of the receiving home, turn us round. And ain't gonna let no cops turn me round. We're gonna keep on a-walking, keep on a-talking, walking up to freedom's land."
Boy,
well, this was like dynamite.
The guys who heard that.
This was like dynamite in here, because these guys in here, I don't know if you remember, the guy who rode around on his bicycle stabbing people, he killed 12 people in one day, and he was there. Rapists. You know, these were the kind of boys that were there. And we were in the boys' section. And we walked in there. Mr. Cole walked up to us and he says, "Shut up. Listen, you guys." He says, "We're going to be your friends if you be our friends. And if you want to get these guys to jump us because you're inciting a riot right now." He says, "Next time any of these guys get around us, they're going to jump us." He said, "It happened a month ago. 15 boys jumped 2 of our social workers and almost killed them. This is like dynamite." He says, "You can't do this. Please." "All right, Mr. Cole. All right." So they checked us and they gave us showers and they gave us uniforms. They took all our clothes and all of our possessions. They gave us special uniforms. I guess that was so we wouldn't have any secret dynamite bombs on us, concealed or anything. I don't really know what the purpose of this was. But then we were put downstairs, all in our own section alone, and this guy walked down. He was supposed to be our supervisor, our social worker. He walked in there, and we were laying on the concrete floor with roaches and cockroaches running around. Laying on the concrete floor. This was their auditorium. We had shoved all the chairs away, laying around on the stage and things. He walked up, he jumped on the stage. He says, "First of all, you guys are all here for the same thing, civil disobedience, right?" We nodded. He says, "Well, before I go any further, I just wanted all you to know I'm on your side." We all applauded, and it turned out that even Herman Cole, every single person in that receiving room, including inmates and staff, was on our side that we talked to. We bump into somebody. We bumped into somebody and we said, he walk up to us, you know, and we start talking. And we said, "What are you in for?" He said, "Possession of stolen goods. What are you guys in here for?" "Oh, we arrested in a peace demonstration." His eyes lit up. He says, "Oh, really? You're going to do it again once you get out, aren't you?" And we assured him that we would. Well, we all got out. Bob Swan from CNVA, who was head of Washington Summer Action Check, was most of the boys were released in his custody. I wasn't released in his custody. I was released in the custody of Stan Robbins.
Is that Robbins' son?
Yes, Ollie Robbins' son.
Uh-huh. Is he a lawyer in Washington?
Yes, he's a lawyer in Washington. Oh. And I went over to his office with Ron Jacks, and I met Judy and Sharon, another girl from St. Paul who had just driven up. Well, she drove halfway and her car broke down, so she ended up hitchhiking the other half with another girl. The two girls drove together. car broke down. They ended up hitchhiking half the way out there. They had just gotten out there. And Judy Barnes and Larry. And I still didn't know where Robin was. And I hadn't seen Robin since I was arrested 2 days ago. So I kept saying, where was Robin? And nobody seemed to know. And Judy walked in, and I said, Judy, where's Robin? Oh, she's down in France. You know, I collapsed. What a relief. Well, make a long story short, Stan Robbins offered us his nice hospitality, and we got Robin, because we didn't have any place to stay that night. It was really too late to stay at home that night. So we stayed that night.
Called your father.
Yeah, we called him. Tell him I was out. And Stan Robbins offered us his hospitality and gave us a wonderful steak dinner, the first real nice dinner we had had in a long time. And next morning we left for home. And Pat Larson came with us. So four of us came back because Pat Larson was another driver and she wanted us home. Irving did not get arrested with us because he went back. He had a ride from Madison, leaving Monday morning, so he did.
Is he from Madison?
No, he's from St. Paul. Oh. He wanted to ride back with us, but we got arrested. So he got to ride as far as Madison and hitchhike.
Boy, that's a wonderful.
And I just want to say that while I was in Washington, I was in Washington from Thursday night to Tuesday night. For all that time, there was only two nights that I slept in the same place. And that was the two nights I spent in front of the White House.
Where did you meet Abe?
Who?
Abe Weisberg.
The day that was Sunday. The day that we were supposed to have workshops and seminars. And he had a table set up and he was selling these books. And I didn't know who he was, but the book looked interesting, so I bought it. Yeah. And I had it sent to the Mariela Seward Library Foundation, and he noticed that this is where I had it sent.
What is that?
And he said, oh, you know Mariela? And I said, yeah, she's my grandmother. He said, will you give her a note from me? And I said, yeah. I did. I met somebody else who said her name was Zelda Batts.
Oh, did you John Merrill?
Merrill didn't know her, but I said, you're from the Twin Cities? I said, yeah. He says, oh, do you know some of the radical people in the Twin Cities? I said, well, I think I know some of them. He says, you know the Elanies? I said, the Elanies? You mean like Zev? He says, yeah, Zev's parents, you know? I said, yeah. So, would you tell him you saw Zelda Batts? I said, yeah, I will. And this kept happening to me.
Did she ask you about Mariela?
No, woman, do you know Zelda Batts? No, I don't think this woman knew Mariela, but she knew the Elanies.
Didn't you say Ruth Gage Colby asked about
Mother? Is that who it was?
Well, I didn't know.
I don't know her. I don't know who it was, but somebody asked about you, Mariela.
Oh, you mean the one who left you the note?
No.
And
there's this woman who was leading the a seminar against UAC.
I thought that was Ruth Gage Colby.
Yeah. I think that. I didn't know what her name was.
Or Ann Braden.
I wouldn't recognize her name.
Mm-hmm. Not really at all.
You might be interested in this, Mariela. Here's a list. Here's the plan schedule for what we're going to have. Now, Friday schedule, 11 a.m., assembly in front of the White House for registration. Noon, silent prayer vigil in front of the White House. 12 o'clock, mass meeting at the Federal Office Building or in Lafayette Square across from the White House. Speakers.
What great planners they are, isn't
speakers.
It?
Joan Baez, Rabbi Feinstein, Robert Paris, A.J. Muskie, and others. Now, this is what was planned. It was much enlarged, this, for from a half an hour vigil is large to an hour and a half. The Saturday schedule, 9 to 11, assembly at Sylvan Theater on the Movement Grounds for folk sing. This was just crossed out at all. 11 to 12, lunch break. The whole day was
too many people.
11 to 12, the lunch break. Well, the whole day everybody was sitting around in the assemblies eating lunch. 12 to 6 o'clock, workshops. 1, HUAC workshop. 2, Washington, D.C. area problems. 3, apartheid in South America. 4, was left to the discretion. 5, Dominican Republic. 6, conscientious objection to war. 7, religion and social action. 8, Puerto Rico. 9, was left open. 10, the congressional challenge in the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party. 11, community organization. 12, free university. 13, free student union. 8 o'clock to 10 o'clock, possible regional meetings and area. You see, everything that happened, it wasn't on here. And this was the list.
No.
And this is the list of other assemblies and workshops that were going to be had. And this is the places that they were going to do them. Now, none of these really turned out as planned. Because a lot of them we just junked. No one decided they liked. And we added a lot more.
Community people, that's good. That's wonderful. What a piece of organizing.
Jim Crow of Interstate Customs, he wrote the following verses. And to this day, nobody knows his name. And he changed the chorus. all the